So that's a good option. So if you can figure out Bitcoin with nuclear, given look at the deals of nuclear, look at how it's structured. And if you can make that work with a Bitcoin community, you can maybe start and say we could have a nuclear power station for a Bitcoin community, just through the mines and these things, and that's going to pay for it. And maybe, you know, with that, you can find a performant asset.
Hugo Kruger, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. And yourself, Kevin? I'm doing well.
Just doing great. Wonderful Sunday. The sun is shining. Yeah. It's beautiful. I mean, you got this view over the mountains.
Wonderful Sunday.
Yes.
Shine.
All right. I turned off the YouTube, so I don't have echo. All right. So, Hugo, now we were planning to do a live chat together with Matthew Arrett and in event two with Cynthia Chung, his wife. Now, because of the actual, you know, the current things going on in Russia, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Like, what is your theory? What do you think about this whole situation? Is this like a huge psyop or?
I've been nearing that. I have no idea, man, because I've stopped following, like most people. I think we're tired of that war. I was on a show the other day, and I just say what I've been saying since the beginning, which is that war would not have happened had we implemented the Minsk II protocol, the one at the existing peace treaty. Everyone knows that. So it was provoked. It's not unprovoked litigation nonsense. There was major provocations. There was funding of death squads in Ukraine by the CIA. People being burned alive in, I think, what they said was in 2017, if my memory now serves. So there's lots of bad stuff happening. They wanted the Russians to invade. Russia invades, and now everyone throws up their hands and say, Putin is Hitler, you know. That's basically what's happening. So, you know, war has now gone on, and the only way to end it, so South Africa's president was there yesterday or the day before with the African Russian summit, and the African leaders are saying the right thing, in my view, which is end the war. Whatever you can, stop the fighting, stop killing people, because it's young men being dead, it's senseless. No war has ever, you know, ever makes sense. But it won't happen unless the United States joins the peace process. That's my view of it. So now, to your more recent question, what's happening with Wagner and Putin and who's this guy? Lukashenko is mediating between Wagner and Putin. I mean, this whole thing doesn't add up to me.
Yeah, that's extremely weird. Now, what I didn't know, I mean, because I just read an article that I didn't know a little bit of the history of, also about Putin's father was the cook of Lenin.
Oh, really? I don't know. I know he wasn't in, I'm not sure if that's true. I know that he was in Crimea or something.
Yeah. And the some funny thing is, on top of that, is that, what's his name? Brzezinski. How do you pronounce his name?
Brzezinski. Yeah, I can't pronounce. Yeah, that guy.
The guy, yeah, who was sort of now kicked out, or I don't know. Maybe I think it's a whole theater, because I think they're best buddy, these two, because he's or used to be the cook and best friend of Putin. So I'm really, I don't know. There's a lot of credible stories from, you know, other experts.
I've asked friends in Russia what's going on.
Just cashed it in. You know, maybe, you know, this accounting error by Pentagon, and maybe it wasn't like 6 billion, but at least, you know, a billion or two, maybe they cashed it in, you know, played 4D chess, and then, you know, played along, and, you know, but who knows?
I don't know. We'll see what happens. I mean, but so when I speak to people in Russia, they say they don't think it's a coup. We don't know. It's just it's a staged event, and they basically maybe trying to launch another offensive because of this thing. I guess we'll find out in a week's time what's happening. I just sort of like, I hear all these theories, and I don't know what to believe anymore. It just sounds weird. That's all I'm saying, because Wagner, as far as I know, is defeating some of the Ukrainian armies at Bakhmut or something. They kill the men. And now all of a sudden, this guy wants to take over. There's also a story related to Africa where apparently Wagner's got lots of soldiers staged all over the Sahel. Mm-hmm. And they're involved in coups and things over there. So, you know,
because they're mercenaries, right? I mean, they're a bunch of mercenaries.
Basically, but it seems that like almost a country on their own. They sort of like an arm of the Russian army. Mm-hmm. Also, the United States has mercenaries and these complicated things all over Africa. And it seems that they're just playing geopolitics in other countries now. And it's weird. But I have no I have no idea what to make of this whole thing, other than it's so strange, you know.
Okay. All right. So let's continue our conversation from last time. I thought we could cover maybe or talk about some topics or subtopics we wanted to cover. I wanted to cover. So, you know, I mean, it's always good, you know, to talk about Russia and China because it always ties in into Iran somehow, geopolitically, macroeconomically, strategically, and technologically. So first of all, yeah, I just wanted to point out Matthew Arrett and his wife Cynthia Chong wrote, I think, a few articles, but two of them I just like to point out. One of them is called let me see what it's called, Iran Century and a Half Fight for Sovereignty by Matthew.
Interesting. Arrett.
Yeah, it was published in June 13th, 2023. And the other one is by his wife, Cynthia Chung, The Sword of Damocles of Western Europe. It's a part one and two, a three-part series, Introduction to the Shah of Shah's Kingdom of Kings. So yeah, I just wanted to, I'm going to put them in the show notes, but I thought to understand a little bit about the history, the background, and the involvement of the CIA, MI6, and even Mossad, because I, you know, I mean, fact is that the SAVAK, the former secret police under Shah, had been trained, you know, by CIA and MI6 and Mossad, and one of the most cruel, very cruel secret police force. So, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, look, it was basically Gestapo, for lack of a better word.
Exactly.
This is not just in Iran. They use it in Latin America as well. They train secret polices there to oppress the population. Ecuador is a good example. El Salvador is another example. You know, this is how the U.S. Has always supported fascism. It's a point that Noam Chomsky made so many times ago, when it suits the geopolitical strategy. So, you know, the history of Iran is, it's a rather tragic history because, you know, they had the great Persian Empire years ago. And the last century has been a century of humiliation. So the way I understand it is they were first humiliated by Russia in the beginning of the last century, and then afterwards by Great Britain. And then even the Iranians at the time, the I think it was the Qajar elites, they thought that maybe it's good to invite America as a counterbalance to Great Britain when Britain ruled the oceans and the world. So then, you know, America became dominant. America started wanting the oil. They invaded Iran with the Soviet Union after, and it's Britain and America after the Second World War. But America, you know, eventually tried to develop the oil fields when oil became valuable. There's a long history of that thing, and they were always intervening in the internal affairs of Iran. Now, given the historical depth of Iranian society, they didn't like this. They don't like being bossed around. They don't like it when somebody else is training a secret police that's oppressing you. And it's not difficult to see how, from this point perspective, Ayatollah Khomeini came to power. But everyone thinks of the guy, we can understand why the Iranians supported him. And this is something the Americans has never come to terms with, because they always think that they can win back Iran. As if, you know, even if Iran opens up and trades today and thinks it's going to become a pro-American country. Nonsense. With that long history of intervention, whatever government remains in Iran, democratic or not, will be very skeptical of the foreign intervention of the United States. The same issue in South Africa, by the way. We have a democratic government, but they do not play along with the Western world because they understand the geopolitical games that's being played with them.
Mm. Now, you are married to an Iranian, and as you know, as we talked before, I mean, I was born in Iran and raised until 7 years of age in Shiraz in Iran, and then my father took me then to Austria. He had been in Austria in the late 50s and early 60s, studied medicine, but half like medicine, but then he went back, you know, worked for several foreign, like international corporations, also Austrian, US, James Scott and Siemens, and sort of, I think, technical advisor or something. Anyway, so the thing what always, you know, when I contemplate or when I talk with other, you know, exiled or you know, people who escaped from either before or during the revolution, 1979, is that because when was the first time you were in Iran, Hugo?
I would say 2 years ago, the first time, really.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, because I was there until 1979, and I do somehow impartially, vividly remember what it was like, you know, the whole mindset, the mentality, the culture. It was like super modernized, you know, super westernized, pretty, I would say, open and free society, right? So this is what a lot of people, you know, confirmed with me. It's like, it's a little bit shocking. A lot of people, I mean, I hadn't been back to Iran since 1980, actually, because I went there once to visit my mom because my parents had been divorced. And so the thing is like, it's a little bit shocking because if it wasn't like for this Islamic theocratic, whatever Islamic regime, I think we would have a different, still have, you know, this open, open-minded and.
Yeah, I agree. Look, the problem is that the Iranians during the revolution, they were right to demand independence. Let's be clear on that. They even have some aspect of democracy today, I would even argue, but they have this weird religious fanaticism that's always overshadowing the society, this Velayati Faqih type of nonsense, right? And that is the thing that needs to be worked against. There is a dark element to it. I mean, look at the women's rights protests, look at the amount of executions every year, look at all these things. Nobody wants to live in a society like that. But I do still think that there is an Iranian identity, and this goes missing in the conversation, that is still very strong. There's still a lot of people who love the country, even those who've left. You know, they still look back and they say they want to go back home. So,
But they do say, you know, people have changed. You know, it's like the whole atmosphere has changed. And, you know, when you remember the old times in Iran, up to the whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think you must be very careful here. If I look at statistics about Iran, when this revolution occurred, only something like 30% of Iranians could read and write. So those who remember the good times back then,
okay, yeah,
they were living in isolation from their own society. That's my view. Okay, I know some people disagree with that. And it was not that great for everyone. So if I look at the level of development that's taken place, I've traveled all over the country now, twice, okay? I give that government credit to achieve under sanctions what other governments around the world could not do, which is allowing to feed their own populations. They've done that. That is the Islamic government. That is difficult for many Iranians in exile to accept, because it means you need to accept that even that government, as evil as it is and as bad as it is, and all these things that we read about in the media, has some form of legitimacy in the eyes of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where I think I find the Iranian diaspora is in a very difficult situation, because they love their country, they want to see a change, they don't know what to do, okay? And they look back and they say, we want to have an open society, we want a democracy, all those great things. But because of that, they become very susceptible, in my view, to propaganda from the Western world, which is to radicalize them against the entire society, and to have hatred for the people back there. And when I go and I speak to the people who live there on everyday life, they sometimes feel this way. They sometimes feel like the Iranians who we see on our and Western media, right, do not speak for them anymore. That there's a disconnect between the two populations. And you two need to reconnect on some level. And it's easy, you speak the same language. You still speak the language and the culture. And it's only through that way that you'll change society. My view has always been, Iran has to change slowly, okay? And it has to change democratically. And it can do so. It's not that difficult given its constitution. The Iranian constitution, the Velayati Faqih, allows for referendums on important questions. And one important question is the role of Islam in society. It's a question of electorate. It's a question of separations of power, all these things. So the pathway for democratic change is there, but it needs to be used by the people. I'm very skeptical against anyone that wants a revolutionary change, because look at what happened last time. You know, last time it was a disaster. So that's sort of my position on it. You know, I say it's an outside observer, you know, semi-outside, my wife's as well, because I understand, you know, I understand the Iranians in my that I meet. Last night we had a guest from Iran as well. He feels the exact same way as you do. Like, I completely understand. I have empathy for their position, but I want them to understand the greater geopolitical context before they try and propose solutions for their country. And sometimes that message is not being communicated.
Yeah, no, I get you what you're saying. Now, the thing is, with all the sanctions, with all the embargoes, I mean, the population now, you know, you probably have heard this there's a saying, I don't know, a lot of Iranians said, oh, you know, during Shah time, one person within the family, you know, was able to work and, you know, could feed 10 other people. And now 10 people, you know, work to feed one person. So would you
I'm not sure that's true. No, I think that's just not true. And I think that's part of it. It might have been true if you were a little bit in the cities and better off. I'm not sure. The average woman in 1979 Iran had 6 children. Today it's less than 1. Okay. The status of women has improved under the current government. Okay, at least from an economic perspective. Iran trains today more engineers than the United States of America. Okay, 60% of them are women. Okay, so that needs to be acknowledged somewhere along the line of the message to get an accurate picture of what's going on. It is not true that the lives of ordinary Iranians haven't improved in the society. I'm sorry, but that's just false. If I look at it through social economic measures, World Bank data, doesn't matter how you do the analysis, you find that the Iranian government is, I argue they are more nationalist than they are religious. And that's an important distinction to make. But yes, I agree, there's nationalist fanaticism, there's religious fanaticism, and those are the elements you want to weigh, very hardcore Iranians. You want to try and neutralize them so the democratic guys can make their argument. But by, you know, making statements like that, which is just false, it's not helping anyone, you know.
Yeah, okay. No, I would just, I know that, and I know that a lot of the conditions have improved, actually, because you talked about the literacy or illiteracy. You talked about the, and I do think that, let's say, women's rights, yeah, a lot of things have changed and improved, actually, within the last, whatever, 4 decades or something. Now, maybe we can make a segue into, now the Iranian population, the Iranian government or Iranian nation state has had some time to you know, to do their own thing, especially technologically, structurally. I think a lot of even maybe even hygienics or the way cities look like and a lot of things have definitely improved. But I mean, is there anything that has deteriorated?
Well, I mean, the right of freedom of expression has varied throughout the country, even under this government. Because remember, they have different factions within Iran. Okay, so there was a time under Khatami, for example, when it was more open than it is today, and was under Ahmadinejad, for example. Okay, the current government in Iran is very hard-lined. So when you have that, you have a security force that responds. And my biggest worry in Iran is that the role of the Revolutionary Guard in everyday life and all institutions is so deeply entrenched.
Yeah.
So you have a quasi-Gestapo ruling the country. And getting that out so those institutions can be under democratic rule is very difficult. That is one of the things that is the most dangerous. And that's why I think it's very dangerous for any country like America to instigate another coup d'etat. Because if you're going to try it, the security force is going to kill their own people. Because security people don't talk, they don't listen, they just kill because they care about safety. You know, so those conditions are very hard. Then also for women with their hijab, for example, during the time of the Shah, they had a choice. They don't have a choice at the moment. So even though women's economic position has improved, their status and their social condition in many ways have deteriorated. You know, so you need to really identify what issue you're talking about. That's just the point I'm trying to make. You know, everything is a trade-off. There are things that were way worse during the Shah's time, and I don't think people need to celebrate that time. I also don't think a king is a good way to rule any country, you know. The Iranians are far more intelligent and democratic anyways. But when I speak to ordinary Iranians, they express their opinion, actually, on the streets. The government, though, shuts down the internet for protests, and they kill people if the riots get too big. They kill children, you know, which is unacceptable in the world. They do all those things, and those are the things that need to change, and that people need to find to change. The way I propose we do it as outsiders is we stay out of their affairs and we allow the atmosphere for them to do so. And that's why I'm not in favor of sanctions. I think sanctions are, you see, because here's the problem. All these evil things we talk about become intensified when you put the government under pressure. And we're sanctioning them, we're punishing them, we're doing this, we're doing that. That's making it worse. And that's what I support, you know, the reform-minded people in Iran who said, you guys are nuts for what you're doing. You don't understand.
Yeah. And Iran, I mean, would have been one of the last domino, you know, one of the last dominoes to fall, according, you know, as you probably know, this talk by the general who said, you know, he was even shocked by this U.S. general, whatever, you know,
Wesley
said
Clark.
Exactly. Yeah. So whatever after
Yeah, look, there was clear intention by George Bush to invade Iran. It was openly stated between George Bush and Tony Blair that an email exchange, and then General Wesley Clark confirmed it, and then the evidence was overwhelming. But it's thanks to the Iraqis, okay, that the Iraqis resisted American rule. They negotiated the Americans out of Iraq, even though Americans had troops there. The Americans could not have a halt because of their own insurgencies. They blamed Iran for funding those insurgents. I don't believe that's even true, because some were not. It's local people in Iran that said, in Iraq had said enough. And it's thanks to the courage of the Iraqis that Iran was not invaded. Because the saying was the road through to Tehran goes through Baghdad. Mm-hmm. And the Americans have been negotiated out of the Middle East thanks to the local populations. They have just said, we had enough. We don't want to... We're not a colony. That's basically what they're saying. We are our own independent people.
Yeah. And Iran, as you know, has unimaginably, done a huge, thanks to the, Iranian population, the Iranian scientists, technologists, the younger people, because I think, whatever one thinks and I think about this tyrannical Iranian regime is that still, they have this wisdom, obviously, they have had this wisdom to say, you know what, just think outside the box. Maybe it's time, as I said last time, not to copy others, but maybe let others copy us by opening up technologies and be more creative on every level, whether it be nuclear, plasma technology, defense technologies, conventional defense technologies, or what have you. So if they, the Anglo-American, whatever military industrial complex, if they had the chance, that would have been like 30, 40 years ago. They should have like attacked, invaded Iran a very long time ago. But now it's impossible, from my point of view. What do you think?
Well, it's very costly if they do it. You see, because Iran, if you go to Bushehr, for example, the Iran's got its military arsenal facing the Saudi Arabian oil fields. So what is it saying? If you invade us, we blow the hell out of your oil fields. They send missiles and rockets into there and they'll destroy the whole thing. So it takes the world economy with them. So they have looked, they have to fortify their defenses. It's also a very mountainous area. Remember, you've got the Zagros and the Elbrus Mountains. It's the walls of Iran. No army can go over those things. So the Iranian soldiers are stationed there. If you go to Azerbaijan, where I was 2 years ago, on the border between Azerbaijan and Iran, it's a military base over there.
Mm-hmm.
So they've stationed the military for the defense of their country. All Iranian men serve in the army. The army is served in local communities where they have local intelligence. It's like the Swiss army. They've structured it that way. So they know how to defend their own country. Okay. And why? Because they have reason to believe that they would be invaded. So my view of Iran is, you speak of technology. They've got good engineers and they've got good technology.
Yeah.
And of all the developing countries, South Africa, Brazil, Russia, India, and Iran, Iran has got is one of the only country with an educated youth that's highly skilled.
Yeah.
Okay. Iran publishes more PhDs a year than Russia at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
So if they open up to the world economy and draw investment, it's the ideal place for investment. Right? They've got all the high level skills for the high level economy and to become an Asian tiger, like the Japanese were. And they're already thinking of this, the leadership. So if you open up the economy, it become a extraordinarily strong country. It's not even a threat to America. That's the joke of it. Because the states in America that will benefit the most from imports from Iran will be Republican states. So all the incentives are there to stop our nonsense with Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But we are, I don't know, we're still stuck in the mindset as if it's the 1979 revolution. And that's something I'm trying. It's trying to open up that conversation is very difficult.
Yeah. You probably know under the reign of the Shah, the United States or the Anglo-American imperials, they had the plan to make Iran sort of the nuclear center, not only nuclear energy, but nuclear weapon.
If you go to Isfahan's Hole in the Mountain, where there's a nuclear program that the Americans gave. MIT at the time thought nuclear power was too expensive in America, they'll screw it in Iran under the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
So the Americans don't care about nuclear weapons. They've never cared about it, right? The reason they care about Iran's nuclear program is because of its independence. It's got nothing to do with it. America's given nuclear weapons to Pakistan, new Muslim country.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. They don't concern themselves about it.
Yeah. Maybe we should get this question out of the way. There is no way Iran is into it. Whatever we think about this Iranian regime, but maybe it's not even necessary to develop. Just out of... logical conclusion or analysis, it would be insane, you know, to develop nuclear or build nuclear weapons. And maybe they don't need it. Maybe they have.
No, they've stated very carefully. It's been stated by Khamenei. Let me read you the quote that Khamenei said, because people don't read, you know, it's something that I, give me 1 second. Let me show it. So this is a quote that was given by Khamenei in 2012. Okay. He said, nuclear weapons neither ensure security, nor do they consolidate political power. Rather, they are a threat to both security and political power. The events that took place in the 1990s showed that the possession of such weapons could not even safeguard a regime like the former Soviet Union. And today we see certain countries which are exposed to waves of the insecurity despite possessing atomic bombs. That is Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei in 2012. It's a fatwa that he gave against nuclear weapons. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. They have a capability program. They keep the centrifuges. They tell the Americans, we are able to make a weapon. And look at how they negotiate. They spin centrifuges. They spin it down. They said, we will bring it down if you give us concessions. That is their grand strategy. And the U.S. has never understood it. So they're going to 60% now. Why 60%? Because you use it for submarines. They're making nuclear submarines. But they're not going to 90% enrichment. Now they say, okay, we can bring it down to 20-30%. Why? Because that's all you need to run a reactor. You know, so they figured out how to play on the psychology of the Americans and Israel. And the other argument here that comes in is Israel. Netanyahu now is facing prison sentences. What is not being said, the reason he's facing prison sentences is he's involved with a nuclear smuggling mafia. Okay, uranium smuggling mafia. The International Atomic Energy Agency is waiting for him. Okay. And he's trying to scare about the threat of Iran to evade prison sentences.
Oh.
And Israel has always had this tactic. When there's internal conflict in Israel, they try and amplify threats outside of the country.
Yeah.
So this
and Israel is still the only country right now that has not never, you know, always has always refused to sign the, what do you call, non-proliferation treaty?
Well, India has also not signed it, but India is a much more powerful country. Israel has a policy of nuclear ambiguity. It's complete farce. So we all know Israel's nuclear weapons. They probably have 70 of them. Netanyahu, Israel's never acknowledged or said or not said. It's a deception tactic of nuclear weapons. We know that the Americans tried giving them, but what isn't said, the way they got it is through mafia smuggling. And there's a very good argument. You see, here's the problem. Iran has proposed for the Middle East a nuclear peace, free weapon zone. If that zone comes into effect, Israel is forced to sign a non-proliferation treaty. If the non-proliferation, Israel is found to violate the non-proliferation treaty, what does that mean? Under existing U.S. law, all aid to Israel must be suspended immediately because you're not allowed to give it to a country that violates the NPT. That's U.S. law.
Oh, that's a leverage. Okay, I see. Mm-hmm.
You see the problem here. So that means the Palestinian question will have to come into answer first, because you cannot... the international law will force you to solve your internal conflicts. So that's why there's such a... This is the greater politics that's being at play here. I just quickly want to get my charger. If you give me like 2 minutes, okay? I'm coming now.
Now, while Hugo is gone again, I would definitely advise you or recommend the articles by Cynthia Chung and Matthew Arrett. Cynthia Chung is Matthew Arrett's wife, but they're both, you know, brilliant investigative researchers, journalists, written a bunch of books. But yeah, these
all two. Right, that's great.
Yeah.
I'm back here.
All right, we're back. So let's go back to Iran. And who do you think, I mean, is, because there's some things, you know, I cannot verify. I mean, who are these ayatollahs or mullahs in Iran? Are they, what's their agenda? I mean, is there, because Iran is one of the few countries that where the central, the so-called, you know, the central banking system hasn't been established. You know, they still have some sort of independence, monetarily, financially.
Yeah, they still have their own development bank, but they also have their own central bank, and they also have their own economist and things. I don't know. I don't know much about the central bank thing. I always don't know what to make of it. It's true that they haven't been integrated into SWIFT and the international transactions, but they're now signing a deal with Russia,
mm-hmm.
where they're doing currency swaps. And I think they're going to have something similar with China as well. But I've also seen that apparently Chinese trade with Iran is not as high as some people have said it is. So I don't know what to make of this thing. They have their own bank, they have their own politics, they have their own dominant class. What the mullahs think and do, some people think they are stupid, other people think they are rational. I don't think they're completely irrational people. They just make decisions and they're a little bit influenced by religious thinking. It's not different than many American leaders. But I think that the real power play in Iran is something between the religious people and the revolutionary guard. And it's a question of who makes what decision there. And I think the influence of the intelligence agency is incredibly strong in the country.
Okay, you mean by intelligence agency, the Iranian or?
Well, the IRCG, and I know they've got local intelligence as well. So they've got two groups, as I understand it. And I think in any country, like the KGB in Russia or the FSB in Russia, they play a very strong, you know, they play what they call a shadow over power. They feed information to the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it depends what they feed, the leaders will react on it, and they know how to feed information so people will react in a certain way. So this is the same with the CIA in America. It's undoubtable that's the most powerful institution in the United States. You know, so that's how I see it. It's those who control the information control the power. Because I mean, SEPA, they're called SEPA, you know, in Iran. They all have their own bank in Iran, their own development bank. They put into industries. Okay, so this is the type of thing that is happening there. But I know they've got banks that have totally detached themselves from that institution as well. So they've got different competing banks. And I find the banking system very interesting. The Iranians have so many bank accounts from different banks. It's a very strange system.
Okay.
Yeah. So, that's what I know about it.
How do you see, because we talked about like the youth, because 70 to 80% of the Iranian population is around, like pretty young, like around maybe 30, around the age of 30 or younger.
Yeah.
They're desperate. I think a substantial number, I mean, massive, I mean, what is it? What's the population in Iran? 70, 80 million?
Yes, 80 million, so I know.
Okay. How would you, what do you see? Do you see in the foreseeable future, in the next 5 to 10 years, that the conditions, you know, that the suffering?
Many of them have studied overseas, have brought ideas from the West back home. Okay. Many of them have are more open-minded. They're not so attached to the previous revolution. And the Iran-Iraq war, you should never forget the influence of that war on Iranian psychology. Many of them still are so-so about their government. Some support, some don't. But slowly but surely, they are moving through the ranks of power. Okay, and that is the best thing that can happen, is that the old die and the young come in. And I think over time, they will bring the change with them. I'm more optimistic about that because they called it the baby boomerang in Iran. They had so many children after the Iran-Iraq war. And those children are now coming to age. They've had more experience in life at the moment. And they are slowly moving into the ranks of power. And I think if they take over and they've got the right policies and mindset, it will be a very much a nice country. What worries me deeply about Iran is actually that there's a lot of young men who feel that they don't have any hope. They are in their 20s and their 30s. They might not be the most educated sometimes. They're still good with their hands type of people. And they feel that life is really stepping on them. They feel miserable. And that is because of a lack of development. I link that, if I look at these figures, I think it has to do with the electricity crisis. Iran has got the same electricity per person as South Africa, which is very low. And they need more energy and they need more electricity to develop the country. They're also running out of water. So all of these are infrastructure developmental issues that Iran is facing. And they need to start addressing it because their population has grown faster than they've planned for it.
That's surprising because I thought electricity, I mean, they have like, they're so advanced with that nuclear technology, nuclear energy technologies. Yeah. I thought it's like abundance of energy.
They've got no lack of resources. It's just a question of implementing policy. They were late. The government waited about it. And remember, your infrastructure projects last only 50 to 60 years. Then you have to rebuild them. That's actually the case in Europe at the moment. That's why everyone's talking about infrastructure now. I don't know if you've noticed in America as well. The stuff was built in New Deal. They're coming, the wheels are falling off the bus, and we need to rebuild it. And the only way to do that is to mobilize state spending. Okay, so that my view is for infrastructure. I don't believe private infrastructure can work. I know some people disagree on that. And South Africa is having this debate at the moment because ours was built in the apartheid era. Europe is having this debate of look at the wind farms exploding in Germany. You've seen these things, yeah. The reason for this is a crony capitalists are looking for a way to cash in on the infrastructure running out. And what they haven't figured out yet is to escape the laws of entropy, which is all things that turn come to an end. All things will come to an end. And the rich of this is why I think these Davos guys are so in panic, because the population is going to say, if we have to rebuild the infrastructure, we're not going to pay for it. You're going to pay for it. Right. And that is what they're worried about. And I think that is that's a lesson in Iran as well. So the rich has been avoiding the question of infrastructure. They need energy for the new industry at the moment. They need investment. They need some of their own money. I don't know how they're going to get it. And my view, that is the solution to get all these men that are sitting on the streets to try and mobilize them for work a little bit. And, you know, people say when I say that I sound like a dictator, but I don't see another solution.
Now, the thing is, I mean, I'm not a, you know, I mean, I know Matthew Arad loves to talk about, and he's a, you know, super expert and specialist on unipolar, multipolar world. And, you know, and now we have this Belt Road Initiative with BRICS and, you know, all this infrastructure, because I mean, the Chinese, you know, instead of going to war and imperialistic, you know, build up, but they do build, they do invest more rationally, you know. But so do you, I mean, under these conditions, I mean, do you see like in a foreseeable future with China, Russia, like building parallel systems, monetary, financial, technologically, infrastructurally, that this could alleviate, you know, this suffering?
I mean, I hope that's the case. So, for example, Africa is the biggest consumer of Chinese infrastructure skills outside of China. There's infrastructure projects all over the world. You see, the Chinese come with a different form of development. The World Bank loans money to countries, and then they must find the contractors to build it. Now, from a construction point of view, that's a very bad way of doing it. Why? If I loan money and you build something, I take the risk. Okay, what do we do in the construction, in this German construction? We say to you, if you're going to build something, you bring your own loan. I pay you afterwards. You carry the risk. If that is, or we split it. If you can't do it because some projects, we split it between builder and constructor. If that happens, what happens? Compliance. Your bank's going to say, can you do it? Are you a good man? You know, what is your record, etc. They ask all those questions, give me a plan, etc., etc. So what do the Chinese do? They say, we come with the wallet. We will build you a highway and you pay us when that highway opens up at a certain tariff. And that tariff will only pay for the highway. That's the same model that America had during the New Deal. That's the same model Europe had during the Marshall Plan. It's not a new model. It's not the Belt and Road. It's not something that is, you know, out of this world type of the imperialism. It is just a model of development, good old developmental economics. And the Chinese have figured it out. It works to the favor of us in Africa because we don't have lots of money. We don't have pension fund money to gamble away on infrastructure that will go boom and bust on because people skim money off the thing. So it is a win-win situation for everyone. And that is, my view, the model that America must get intact with if it wants to compete against the world. The World Bank model does not work, the IMF model, because money goes missing. So that is one way to do it. The other way Iranians can do it is they can use their own money because they have some savings, actually, and they can use that to rebuild their infrastructure. But either way, somebody's going to pay for this stuff. And infrastructure will have to be rebuilt. Otherwise, we are going to sit with problems that our cities will collapse.
Yeah.
So sooner or later, the populations will wake up.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned World Bank and IMF. I mean, I mean, I didn't know all of this about how exploitative and what a systemic theft, you know, the IMF and World Bank and you know, the central banking structure has perpetrated in Africa and so many other, you know, developing countries. It's mind-boggling. And I mean,
it's not everywhere. Sometimes they have good projects. Okay?
I just want to refer to Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation. He wrote like brilliant articles and books by now. And there's some facts. I mean, hardly anybody knew about that. It just, I think, came to the surface now in the last few years. But this is why, you know, we are as a community such huge advocates of Bitcoin, because it will just obsolete everything else. It just a new
system. But how are you going to fund logical infrastructure on Bitcoin? I'm not convinced of that. Bitcoin to me is still, I've tried to figure it out, but you need massive amounts of capital expenditure. You know, how are you going to get a loan and things of that sort if on the Bitcoin community?
This is solvable. I don't think that's a huge challenge, to be honest with you. I mean, the thing is, we're finally this, you know, it's not going to be, you know, you talked about crony capitalism. I mean, it's systemic theft that's been going on for at least 100 years through the central banking structures and governments, of course, intertwined and but like creating debt out of nothing and you know, playing with interest rates and you know, and the whole
I agree with you. These banks and the way they've been stealing money from the taxpayer, that's the accusation against them. It is there. My question still is, can you deliver the necessary investment for a population to rebuild, say, the interstate highway in America, which is a massive infrastructure project, on anything else than government money? That means we have to pay taxes for it. Can you really do that on Bitcoin? I would like to believe that is true, but I don't know if somebody's going to fund it. And this is a problem that I think the libertarians who tend to be Bitcoin people generally run into, is that they look into short-term profits, which is 10, 15, maybe 20 years. And on that basis, maybe Bitcoin can pay for some things. But whether or not it can run for 60 years type of infrastructure, which, I mean, take the Golden Gate Bridge in the United States. It was built in San Francisco, one of the largest bridges in the world. It was built in 1932. The debt on that bridge was only paid off in the 1970s.
Yeah, because 1913, you know, the Federal Reserve was created, and then, of course, 1971 was the official, you know, the Nixon shock going off the gold standard. But actually, going off the gold standard began actually shortly before the First World War, to a substantial degree. So, I think just going off this gold standard or leaving the gold standard, and then, you know, not having, you know, any backing or redeemability. Is, but okay, you know, it's a whole, I think, discussion by itself, but it will definitely change the time preference, you know, because Bitcoin, it's never been done in history, you know, in the history of mankind.
Look, if Bitcoin can do that, if you can take a community of Bitcoiners, something inconceivable can say, we're going to give a loan, like an options, you know. Mm-hmm. You buy into options and that goes to a contractor and that's the infrastructure, or a contractor is a Bitcoiner, but you need to make sure where the risk is being placed. That's all I'm saying. If somebody builds something for you, he must take the Bitcoin loan. Okay. And the problem is, when it comes to these large capital expenditure stuff, even if I take the loan, let's face it, if a project goes bust, I don't have the money to pay you back. So usually the government covers that risk. You understand?
Yeah, but there won't be any, like, you know, like high risk, you know, like sort of, you know, socialized losses system anymore, you know? I mean, this whole system is so criminal. I mean, the criminality has actually been legalized. I mean, through every layer and segment you would analyze it. It's mind-boggling. And I don't see a problem with Bitcoin, even in a Bitcoin, on a Bitcoin standard, a hyper-Bitcoinization system. You know, things going to improve dramatically. We're going to have abundance. We're going to lower the time preference. That means people, for the first time, you know, will more rational, logically, you know, build stuff, invest. And why wouldn't, you know, why would, you know, giving credit or giving out loans, it's not going to abolish, you know, it's not going to abolish the loan system. It's just going to be more rational, more ethical, and more logical, and widen the horizon, and meaning the lowering the time preference. So it's not like about short term, you know, as you said, short term profitability.
So those are the problems maybe I would encourage the people in the Bitcoin community to think of is, you know, to prove my skepticism wrong. You know, I'm not, you know, saying this in absolutism, but to say to them, if you want to fund, rebuild the Golden Gate Bridge, for example, which has to be rebuilt sometime in the future, or the Hoover Dam or any of these things, how are you going to fund it with Bitcoin? How can you have it community owned, property owned? Is it government owned? You know, how does that work? And if you can solve those problems, I think more people would be convinced of it. You know, thus far, construction companies, we still get loans from governments. Okay, this is no secret. and we go and build infrastructure usually for other governments. So it's government to government transactions. The advantage of that is we lock out the middleman.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Because if the banks ask me for the money, they want to make sure their deal is properly structured. Okay. If you get the money to come to me, there's always guys that are saying, how do I get into this deal? And that's where the Davos guys, that's by the way, the Davos guys hate nuclear power, because nuclear contracts are set up in such a way that you cannot get into the deal.
Mm-hmm.
It's set up with, except in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the US is so expensive. But the nuclear power, the international law protocols come into play. And these law protocols say, it's utilities to utilities. There's no money to steal, basically. So that's why it's so open to propaganda all the time, because everyone attacks the nuclear industry for being dirty and dangerous and all the stuff we've heard, which is complete nonsense. And the simple reason is there's no constituency for nuclear. There's no middleman. There's no guy in the newspapers that's going to say, buy nuclear, sell nuclear. It's people like me who work in the industry, I used to even, I'm not in the nuclear anymore, who just love the technology. We explain to the public. And what's ironically is that because only people are explaining it, we're winning the argument. I don't know if you noticed in Twitter and with Oliver Stone's recent movie, things have been changing a little bit. And the other guys are getting hot under the collar because the public is waking up to this.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. And they've now figured out that if you want to lock the guys out of Davos from out of any deal, because we know they're stealing money, you're going to build nuclear power stations.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah. So that's a good option. So if you can figure out Bitcoin with nuclear, given look at the deals of nuclear, look at how it's structured. And if you can make that work with a Bitcoin community, you can maybe start and say we could have a nuclear power station for a Bitcoin community, just through the mines and the things, and that's going to pay for it. And maybe, you know, with that, you can find a performant asset. If you can solve that problem, it will be incredible. I mean, I give that to the geniuses in Bitcoin at the moment. I don't know.
Yeah. But you know, Hugo, I mean, you know, the holistic perspective I and a lot of, you know, much more intelligent people have, like Jeff Booth. I would definitely, you know, urge you to read this, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future by Jeff Booth. And it's called The Price of Tomorrow, Why Deflation is the Key to an Abundant Future. You know, as you know, technology is deflationary, or if we just let it run, it would just lower prices and we would have more comfort, more abundance in society, and that's what Bitcoin is. It's the scarcest money. It has all the dreamlike properties you can think of, and it would just create a system where we finally have the civilization we could have had 100 years ago. You know, we talked about this like last time.
Well, I like the fact that it creates trust between people. Okay, trust and compliance. And as I said, this is the nuclear contracts works the same. It forces trust and compliance. So from that basis, I'm completely in favor of the blockchain protocol. Because somebody gives me Bitcoin and now I'm getting Bitcoin. I'm not getting cash that's going to inflate, right? That's the argument of it. So I like that way. I like the thinking, and those applications. I mean, that blockchain protocol of consensus and how it works and cross-verification, that's very good for other transactions in other day life as well. So I think if we can base our thinking on that, it will be a very good world, because it will lock out criminality, which is what we actually care about. We don't want guys stealing money. We don't want guys. Nobody likes being cheated, things of that sort. So yeah, that's what I expect from them. As I just say, I'm still hesitant to throw my weight around it for anything that is large scale infrastructure. And I would send out this challenge to the Bitcoin community to say, prove me wrong. You know, I would change my mind if I see the evidence.
Right, right. No, I get you. I think I'm trying always, to talk about like the holistic picture, like how many technologies, like super innovative advanced technologies have been suppressed, confiscated in the name of national security, or not developed, because of all these bad, really bad incentives or, controlling structures. So this is what I see, always in connection with Bitcoin, is that finally, whether we're talking about transportation, energy, healing, medicine, the evolution, advancement of humanity, finally we'll have this opportunity, to bring out the technologies and screw the patent system, mm-hmm. because I think it's one of the most criminal theft.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't see why people. It's never made sense to me, because how did America develop? It's still the railway from Europe. Okay, so that is what copyright infringement. How is China developing today? We know they're copying technology, but that's what everyone is doing. The Chinese
look at the trains. Look at the super high high-speed trains. I mean, we don't have that in Austria or in Europe or anywhere. Where are they? Where's the maglev trains? You know, I mean, Japan has it. So something has gone wrong, you know, in our
Well, the thing you must take into account, our infrastructure is older in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's more expensive to rebuild stuff than it is. You need to sometimes upgrade them first. It's still not at the end of its lifetime. If you build a train, you build it for 50, 60 years. So, you know, don't underestimate the intelligence or the capability of the engineers in Europe. They can do it. But it will take time to slowly upgrade it. Because remember, if we throw all our money into new railways, that's money taken from other places of the economy, you know, into it. I mean, as somebody in infrastructure, I like it if somebody tells me build a high-speed railway. But there's a realism that has to come to say our economy works the way it does. Our societies evolve this way with patterns of development in Europe going back thousands of years almost. And you cannot just change it overnight. So if these trains come to the end of their life, which some in France are now coming, slowly they will be upgraded to newer models. But you need to upgrade the railway, you need to upgrade everything. And sometimes it's best to go with a solution that's maybe not the fastest, but the most optimal. You know?
Yeah, I get you. But
you understand? So it's not that simple. The Chinese are lucky because they built from nothing.
Yeah, Hugo, you know, there's not a lack of intelligence or engineers or ingenuity or innovators or inventors or whatever. Yeah, like, we have brilliant minds. It's just the system, whether it be the patent system, the central banking system, the military-industrial complex, the monetary, financial, corporate complex, they don't want it. I mean, there's no incentive. Why would they want it? I mean, this is about control.
Yeah, so but those are the controls you need to fight. And one way to fight it is to mobilize people to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. Okay, what we're doing over here. It's because eventually they will be forced to listen to the electorates. They can only, I mean, look at COVID. Most people went along in the beginning. Eventually people started talking and they pushed back against the narrative. And it was actually a worldwide revolution against totalitarian control. Today, nobody talks about it anymore. The rules are pushed back, you know. There's still some remnant of it, but if you fly today, they don't ask for a ticket anymore. People have forgotten about it. The same is true of the Ukraine war. It was impossible to say negotiate with Russia. Now everyone is saying it. So the more people push back against the doctrine and the ideologies of the elites, the better the society becomes. The mess you bring, that you bring your government, you bring these institutions under democratic rule. And you can't even get rid of them. If you don't like a central bank, there's no world rule in the world that says we shouldn't have them. We can abolish it. And I said, the more people talk and discuss the possibility, the higher the probability will go into policy. And this is what they used to call traditional class struggle, is that ordinary people always feel that these rulers of them don't speak to them. And remember, they're just ordinary people in these organizations. You know, we talk about a deep state and a CIA, and that's fine, but they're just normal people. And they have to eventually listen to people talking. So the way to push back is to talk against this way and come up with solutions. You say Bitcoin has solutions for honest transactions. So use that for some of your transactions, you know.
Now, Hugo, what do you see? I mean, to wrap this up a little bit, what do you see in the foreseeable future in the next 10, 20 years? I mean, do we have a chance to like radically transform the structures we have in...
Well, I'm always skeptical of people who want to radically change the world. I would just slowly change it. I think yes. I think I'm more optimistic. I think there's far more people awake today about how deeply indoctrinated and brainwashed the media is and the politicians are. And I cannot see how this system, you know, this Davos ideology nonsense can last very long. I cannot see. We're seeing signs of it. I mean, look at today. Sweden said Greta Thunberg's ideology is gone. Things of that sort. You see, Estonia lost the government last year, for example. You see, France. Macron was elected as anti-nuclear and pro-Margaret Thatcher. That's how he was elected. Mm-hmm. Today, he's renationalizing EDF, and they are recommitting to nuclear power.
Because people are, I think they're tending more towards the sort of, they call it, I think, right wing or whatever. Is that the reason or?
No, what happened in France was so De Gaulle understood France very well. He understood the French Revolution started when people like you and me talked about our problems. And he placed his strategic national assets all over France, all the nuclear power stations. So when Macron wanted to talk to him, he realized they didn't know what was happening. All these people started mobbing, the ouvriers, the workers. And they form groups like La Voix du Nucléaire to educate the public and each other on nuclear power. And what eventually happened is they forced the elites to listen to us, which was the lesson of the French Revolution. The French Revolution occurred because the elites were too far detached from the ordinary people. And the collective common knowledge of ordinary people is much more stronger than somebody who studied at the Grande École. That was the lesson. To the point now that the political pressure is so strong in any political party in France, left or right, doesn't matter. They have to recommit to the traditional trajectory of France, which was nuclear power. And that is what the French understood. It's not about your politician being left or right wing or your vote. It's about making it too expensive for any one of them to go against your wishes. And that is how the French system, and that's why I think France is a very good country to watch for this, because they're breaking away from this type of thinking. They're going back to traditional thinking, which the Chinese have been doing. So I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic by the changes I'm seeing. I don't think we are there yet. I think we're still far away. But I think a lot of these guys in Davos are very scared of what's happening, because they know they cannot stop the people anymore. They can only try and hide, and they can fly from private jet to the next IPCC conference and pretend in front of the media how love they care the planet, and you know, all these superficial nonsense. People are seeing through it. And it makes me excited that so many people have waked up.
I mean, we could have a fundamental discussion. I mean, one day maybe we could have a fundamental, even with Matthew Arendt, like, what do you think about like nation state? I mean, isn't it time for human species to evolve? I mean, do we really need the nation state? Do we need the government? Do we need?
Sure, but I still believe that human nature is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe there will always be a nation state. I think nationalism, and you know, nationalism is a good thing in some places. Austria has a very good nationalism because of its military service. It's not mm-hmm. a negative nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
The Austrians I've met are very proud of their country, and they, you know, they like serving there. You know, they're not excessive about nationalism. Mm-hmm. And the Swiss have a very good system where they all serve a common cause military since the time of Napoleon. The Swiss love their country. Switzerland's one of the most highly performing countries in the world. Scandinavian countries as well. So I think people need to not be, you see, people are very negative against the institutions. And I think that's part of the propaganda. I think people need to understand their country. They need to understand how it worked historically. And then they need to force those institutions to change. And they can change. Because there's this story going around, it will never change. It is always against us. It's always too much money in the system, etc. I don't believe that for a minute. I believe that if you put enough pressure on your populations and you mobilize, you can bring systemic changes over long periods of time.
Yeah, but that would require Hugo starting with kindergarten, school system, educational system. And
it's part of it. It's part of it.
System. I mean, just look at the children. I mean, we will not send our daughter to school. We're gonna homeschool her. I'm gonna bring the best geniuses minds over here. And you know, I mean, you have to have the time and resource. I mean, I'm aware of that, but you know, it starts everywhere. I mean, it's like the media.
But there is a small change that you can make in your life which can potentially have ripple effects down the way. I think of something similar. At this moment in time, I'm speaking to unions back home in South Africa, educating them on nuclear power, people who work in coal mines, to understand that there's a way out of this thing if the carbon issue is really an issue. Okay, that you can play an important role in your own society. You know, you educating people about Bitcoin. It's an important thing. And all these conversations collectively will have a rippling effect on the on the politicians. And it will force a systemic change. So, you know, what we're doing is very good. And I think we must just continue to make the contribution you can with the limited time you have, because you also have to work and you also have a family. And, you know, we all like that. Most people are not going to be the top leader changing the world, and I'm skeptical of those people. But if you do it in that fashion, I think systemic changes will come. You know, and before you look 10, 20 years when you retire, then your daughter, she might live in a much better world than you live in at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually what people want at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we have to go back to the roots and more to regional, local projects. You know, I'm a huge fan also of this project, Free Private Cities, it's called. I don't know what it's called right now. Maybe it's a different name, but sort of it's a private contractor as a service provider. And you live whatever that is in Honduras, or I don't know, it's like a island for itself,
yeah.
Or, you know, where, you know, technologies come, companies come, investors come, and they build their own regional, local project. And
and you sign up, you know, if you don't want it, you don't want it, you know, but it's a sort of a service provider, right? You pay your whatever fees per year, and you get the services, and you get, you know, the technologies and the infrastructure and everything else. So maybe this is the way to evolve, you know, locally.
Yeah, that's well, you know, it's what Patrick Wood told me is a year or two ago. I spoke to him. He said, you know, think global, but act local.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you need to do. Make the changes you can in your own life. Don't try and change the World Bank. It's not going to happen. But change, you live in Austria, try and be a change you know, in your own society. And if people make those small sacrifices, which can actually be pleasurable, you know, it's actually nice to be involved in communities and things. If you can make those small sacrifices in your own lives, you know, I've learned a lot from you about Bitcoin. I don't know stuff, for example. You know, I'm sure you learned from me about nuclear power. Mm-hmm. We learn from each other. And it's ultimately that collective knowledge. Because let's say this topic of Bitcoin pops up in my own life in the future. I'm going to phone you and say, can you please explain to me what's going on here, here, and here? And you have the answer. Mm-hmm. And you make these connections. And that's how we share and learn from each other.
Right. That was a fantastic conversation. So to wrap this up with Iran, is there like a message you would want to give like to the Iranian population, or especially to the younger people?
Well, I would say don't give up hope, and don't believe that nothing can change the society. Because I don't believe from it. I think the Iranian youth are enormously talented people. Okay, they are very intelligent people, and they have deep conversations, and they understand the problems in their own society. But what they need to do is start speaking to each other and start negotiating and move away from the dogma and the struggles that your parents had. The problems that your parents overcame is not yours anymore. Okay, and find your own, you know, your own challenges. Every generation has its own challenges. Okay, so my view to Iranians is simply that, to find the solution for the problems in your own country, in your own society. And those problems, the answer is not always in politics. Sometimes it is community, sometimes it's, I mean, my wife has a friend, for example. She teaches women. She's a woman entrepreneur in Iran. Very rare thing to have, okay? And she teaches women self-confidence and things of that sort. Every week, she is teaching the deaf people of Iran in Tehran to read and write. You know, so you have things of that sort. Those are people that make the change in the country. And I would say to the Iranians, you need to listen to those people, you know, over a long period of time.
Wow, beautifully said. No, words of wisdom. Anything coming up? Are you writing on an article, another article?
Writing a lot on Substack. I'm doing a lot on nuclear power because South Africa is doing major overall geopolitical changes. And I would like serious discussion in South Africa about nuclear power and the world for that matter. I think the future of energy is nuclear power. I'm convinced of that. The technology we have today might not be the most optimal in terms of nuclear because its full thermodynamic potential has not been exploited. And I think a lot of brains need to look into that and say, how can we bring the costs down? How can we make the things work? How can we make them more performant? All of those things. I think we need to rebuild the traditional ones first to know what we've lost. And then from there, we use that as a basis to make the most more advanced reactors. And it's time we stand up to the environmental lobbyists and the people who say it's not safe, it's not dangerous. Learn your arguments, educate yourself on the technologies. Because my view is what I see in the industry at the moment, that is the future.
Mm-hmm.
All the intelligent kids are going back into nuclear. And I think they, you know, you should usually follow where your brains are in society. So yeah, that's the lesson that I'm sort of leaving.
Yeah. Education, yeah, it always comes back, you know, to education, mm-hmm. and being informed and comprehension, like really holistic comprehension and connecting the dots. I think this is what's always been important to me, like understanding first the bigger picture and going into details. So Hugo, thank you so much. I'm going to add your Twitter handle and your Substack, and any other info you want to have?
No, I think that's all. Thanks for this great conversation. I appreciate
it. Thank you. Yeah, and we'll repeat that hopefully in the very near future with Matthew Arad and or maybe Cynthia Chung. I think it would be a very fruitful discussion. I think it's going to be very fascinating to connect the dots together with you, with all your knowledge and wisdom.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin.
All right, Hugo. Have a wonderful Sunday, okay?
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.